This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. This hour, why the media jumped so quickly on the story of the Wall of Moms at Portland protests. Then, the importance of green space in cities. Also, just what exactly is the national security concern over that viral app, TikTok, where people make silly dance videos? And by people, I mean mostly kids. That's coming up on Top of Mind. It's great to have you with us. A month and a half into the nightly anti-racism protests in Portland, Oregon, a group of women in bright yellow shirts linked arms and lined up in front of the police barrier. The Wall of Moms captured national attention and immediately spawned chapters in cities all across the country. The Portland group is also facing accusations of being anti-Black and of distracting from the message of the protests. Would they have garnered as much media attention had the moms not been primarily white, or if they had just called themselves Wall of Women or Wall of People? Saraya Shamali is a media critic, activist, and author of the book Rage Becomes Her, which looks at the power of women's anger and activism. And she joins me now on the line. Saraya, welcome back to Top of Mind.
Thank you so much for having me today, Julie.
There are a couple of important threads I want to unravel here with you. If these women had not called themselves Wall of Moms and underscored the whole motherhood angle with singing lullabies and wearing T-shirts that say Mom is here or Angry Mama, do you think they would have gotten as much attention?
Probably not. I mean, I think that that calling to motherhood as an identity has always served the political purposes of certain constituencies in the country. And I think that's what they did. And honestly, it resonates with media. It resonates with political media. And I think that's important to note. It's actually what they did, but also how the media responds to what they did.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, there have been many protest movements involving mothers. So mothers of the movement, for example, in the Black Lives Matter movement, those were primarily Black mothers trying to politically address the harms to their children, to their communities, to themselves. And yet media didn't pick that up with this type of alacrity, right? And I think that...
And those are the mothers of many of these young Black men and women who have died.
They were killed.
Right. So Trayvon Martin, Eric Garner, Sandra Bland, Michael Brown. So those mothers have been vocal and active for some time, but they didn't get the same, they haven't received the same kind of attention that the Wall of Moms garnered.
Right. And I think that comes from several things. One is womanhood in the United States being dominated by whiteness, motherhood as a sympathetic political identity also being dominated by whiteness, right? And so we have these racialized divisions in how we perceive women, in how we perceive femininity, in how we perceive legitimate motherly concerns. And I think we saw that here. And so some of it is the women themselves calling themselves mothers, which in the United States in particular has been powerful politically traditionally. If women caveat their political anger with motherhood, they tend to get more traction. And so you can see that in the temperance movement. You can see it in Mothers Against Drunk Driving. You can see it in various mother-focused anti-gun and gun regulation movements, right? And it's almost as though, okay, we understand that we need to predicate our political and public actions with the acknowledgement that we are mothers first and foremost.
Tell me a little more about that. So you dive into one of those examples for me. You said temperance or Mothers Against Drunk Driving. So are you saying that women, when they seek political change, will often use their motherhood or sort of put that part of them out front as a way to protect themselves from criticism they might otherwise get, or to give themselves a sense of legitimacy?
Well, I think it's a way to mitigate resistance to their political activism. I mean, if you know, you don't have, for example, Women Against Drunk Driving, you have Mothers Against Drunk Driving, because we understand women's anger as we rationalize women's anger if it actually confirms our stereotypes about women and their roles in society. So if the stereotype is that women are nurturing, women are caring, every woman wants to be a mother, every woman's going to be a mama bear to protect those children who, you know, will grow up to be citizens or workers or whatever the era designates the usefulness of people to be, right? We can rationalize their anger in a way that culturally we've demonstrated we're not interested in doing otherwise. I mean, if women just get angry and they express their political rage, it's not accepted in the same way that men's anger is accepted.
So anger in the context of motherhood is considered noble, but anger, just a woman who's angry about whatever, the way she's treated or rights that she wants or demands that she's making, that's not noble. Like, it's only okay or only noble if it if it's a mother caring for her children.
I mean, I think that's very prevalent in our culture and in our political thinking. I mean, if a woman is angry in self-defense, if she's angry because her rights are being violated or her citizenship is being degraded or her status as a worker is somehow being threatened, it's not as acceptable as if she puts a stake in the ground and prioritizes the needs of others first. And I think that's an important difference, because we are socialized and we expect girls and women to put the needs of others first. And so when we put our own needs first, as citizens or as workers or just as human beings, we're seen as selfish and ugly and demanding, because we're actually violating the gender norms that dominate. Whereas to be angry as a mother confirms those norms. It's quite conservative in that sense, right? Even if you are advocating for progressive ideals, by asserting your motherhood first, you're actually kind of saying, okay, wink, wink, we understand that we have to do that. And we understand that that's important, and that we are in fact mothers, which is important too, to all of us, right? But by prioritizing it in that way, I would say that it creates a different overall structural support for the gender binary ideas.
It's actually a really savvy political move then. It sounds like.
I don't know that it's even conscious, to be honest. Yes, I think it is probably, but it's also a political necessity, right? I mean, I think women have learned that it's easier to perhaps make that kind of political activism viable if they do that.
I'm speaking with Soraya Shamali, who is a media critic and activist. She's author of Rage Becomes Her. It's about the power of women's anger and the ways in which often women are not allowed, or it's not considered acceptable for women to express anger. Let's talk about the race component of this in a little bit more depth. So the majority of these Portland moms, this initial wall of moms, are white women. And that group has now, in the last few days, come under some schism and quite a bit of criticism for that, for lacking diversity, and also, I mean, in the most direct accusations of being anti-Black. But setting aside the wall of moms for a moment and whatever those motivations are, just the notion of mothers getting deference when it comes to their children, why is it that not all mothers get that deference?
Well, I mean, I think that if you consider heteropatriarchal white supremacy and the way that it defines our social relationships and our political lives and what it means in our institutions, it provides answers to your questions. I mean, you know, I think when you look at the uses and abuses of Black and brown bodies broadly in American history, and you see the way the legacy of that history plays out today. So, for example, let's let's consider maternal harms, pregnancy-related deaths and maternal mortality, right, which is between, depending on the studies that you look at, 3 to 6 times higher for Black women in America than for white women in America. I think it's fairly evident and uncontrovertible that there are disparities in the way we value white motherhood and Black motherhood, right? If we valued women from that perspective equally, even within the framework of motherhood, that disparity wouldn't exist. And so the one of the enduring problems we have is that I think people really still think of racism as an interpersonal dynamic and a possibly an individual pattern or flaw, where in reality, and this is where the shift to systemic racism and white supremacy comes, those dynamics are baked into every aspect of our institutions and lives and social norms. Same thing with heteropatriarchy, I will note, because in fact, we know that single motherhood is institutionally discouraged and disdained, and that the idea of a single mother has been tied grossly disproportionately to young Black women, right? Mm-hmm. Even though we know that single motherhood is in no way, shape, or form restricted to Black girls and women.
So when you see a protest movement gaining traction using motherhood imagery, do you think on the whole it's helping or hurting overall a particular cause?
Well, I think both things can be true. I mean, as a media critic, I can't separate that from the composition of our newsrooms, right? We know that our newsrooms lack inclusivity and diversity. And I mean, I have worked with the Women's Media Center for years now, and the Women's Media Center conducts annual reports on a census of what diversity and inclusion looks like in newsrooms. And the newsrooms lack diversity, and in management of those newsrooms tend still to be dominated overwhelmingly by white men who share education and socioeconomic backgrounds for the most part. So, you know, it's impossible to divorce the demographics of a newsroom from the way newsrooms covered a protest like this. And by that, I mean that the people who make decisions about what political news is important and how to frame it might recognize in white women and white motherhood something that they won't recognize experientially or contextually in Black motherhood, because there simply are not enough people exposed to Black communities or to what's happening in them making decisions in newsrooms. So I would say that, you know, in newsrooms that are really focusing on this particular protest movement, there's an inclination, ultimately, conservatively, to emphasize white motherhood.
And you've mentioned that so much of this is happening subconsciously, perhaps.
Yes.
That for whatever reason, even before we recognize it, these images of these white mothers with, you know, their angry mama bear t-shirts, linking arms and singing lullabies as a way of protecting protesters from the police, that resonates in a way that many of us don't even recognize. And it's probably also, I've read that many of these women who've participated in the Wall of Moms in Portland, it's the first time they've ever been to a protest, but this spoke to them because they are mothers. Given that all of this is happening on an unconscious level, and that motherhood is important, and that it is, yes, an important part of a woman's identity for many women, what do we do about this, do you think, in terms of making sure that it's not, that it doesn't become something that silences other voices or that undermines the voices of women who are not white mothers?
Right. I mean, I think it's very complex, right? And what we have to do about it has to be done at virtually every level of society. So, you know, we have to be having hard conversations in our own homes, at our own dining room tables. We have to be challenging media framing and norms. we have to think really about what allyship means, so that, you know, for people who might be focused in one area of social justice, that they think consciously about how to build bridges with other areas of focus for social justice, instead of maybe blowing those bridges up accidentally, right? It's very hard, but very necessary to be deliberate and self-conscious, I think, in our movements of support. And there was a very interesting article earlier this week. It ran in the Huffington Post, and it was about allyship in the workplace. And that's a little bit different, but in fact, many of the themes are similar in a situation like this. And what the article was saying was that white people at work say that they're really good allies to their Black and Latina peers, especially women. But Black and Latina women are saying almost the opposite. Hmm. And there's this incredible gap in perception of what constitutes being a good ally. And I think you can see that here, right? A lot of these women wanted to do the right thing, wanted to be supported, but in execution ended up behaving in ways that lent themselves to distraction, to possible doubling down on the problems of racism in the media or the problems of racism in the community. And that was probably unintentional, right? But understanding allyship as part of life, instead of a kind of one-off thing that happens at a rally or a protest, is really important to that.
And allyship then is effectively supporting without taking over the message or making it about you.
That's right. I mean, I think that, you know, if you're being an ally to make yourself feel better, because let's say you're thinking, well, I have children, I can understand what that would feel like for me. That's actually different from saying her rights as a human being and a woman and a mother have been violated. What does she need for me to support her in her fight? Also, I think that part of the problem is that if you're starting from a place that you feel is empathetic and you think we're both mothers, that's important. But in fact, the context in which you are mothers can vary tremendously, right? So the assumptions of being a white mother don't just port over to the lives of Black mothers because they're both mothers. They are experiencing power and institutions and systems and society and culture and media in radically different ways. And you can't subsume all of those differences in the idea that we're all the same because we're mothers.
Soraya Shamali is a media critic and author of the book Rage Becomes Her. Thank you very much for taking some time to talk us through this today. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Julie.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes, a look at why President Trump and Congress are so concerned about that silly video app, TikTok. Just ahead, why every little bit of green space in a big city matters. Stay with us. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. So good to have you with us today. A lot of city dwellers have a new appreciation for green space after all these months of quarantining and social distancing. Physical and mental health improve when people have access to a park or a trail. And it doesn't even have to be something as formal as a park. Just a little patch of green area can have value. Venice Jennings studies how green space works in urban settings and why it's not always accessible to everyone who needs it. Jennings is a professor of public health at Agnes Scott College and one of the lead authors on a book called Urban Green Spaces. Professor Jennings, welcome. Thanks for taking time today.
Thank you so much.
What are the physical benefits scientists have been able to link to spending time outdoors?
Well, that's a great question. And physical activity and physical health just undergird so many components of our health and well-being. When it comes to access to green spaces, there have been studies that have linked it to greater, levels of physical activity. And that's, as we know, connected to so many components of our health. And the story goes on in terms of what that can do for us mentally as well as physically.
Okay, so the value of green space is that we're exercising in it. Like, can I just sit every day in the pocket park in my neighborhood and get physical benefits?
Well, you're right. There are different ways that we interact with these spaces. They may be, going for a run, or as you mentioned, just sitting and having that time to really decompress or reflect. And the general change of scenery can also be beneficial to our health.
Okay, so that kind of segues into the mental health benefits. What are some of those that have been scientifically documented?
Well, a number of studies have articulated how spending time in nature can help us to buffer our levels of stress and be able to be, psychologically restored. As you mentioned, us being quarantined or sheltering in place, staying indoors, staying plugged in all the time can really, put us into this not only setting of cabin fever, but really in the sense of us needing to just get a change of scenery. So it has been found to be able to reduce stress as well as mitigate depression and other psychological health challenges.
Now, a person can get outside and even get physical exercise without actually being in a green space. So I'm thinking about, I mean, a city sidewalk, right? There are ways to get outside and ways to get physical exercise. Is there something specifically important or valuable to the physical and mental health of an individual to being where there's stuff that's alive, like, running on grass or surrounded by trees?
No, that's a great question. And it's interesting that there is a hypothesis known as like the biophilia hypothesis that describes how we have that innate need to connect to the natural world as a sense of reconnection from the concrete jungles that we may be used to in some respects. So there are some documented benefits of reconnecting with green spaces and other natural settings as a way to enhance our health and well-being.
What is the most, in your studies, the most useful or most beneficial type of green space in an urban setting? There are lots of options. It could be a little patch of green lawn with a playground on it. It could be like an area where people can run their dogs, which might just be dirt or wood chips or something like that, It could be more like an uncultivated sort of just natural area where people can walk. What is there a difference when it comes to in terms of benefit when you're thinking about the kind of green space someone has access to?
Right, and that's a good question. It's the answer is quite subjective because even when we think of leisure or recreational settings, our choice are dependent on what we gravitate to. Someone may want to go to a park and go for a run. Someone else may enjoy the peace and quiet of just reading a book under the tree and not talking to any of us. So the way that people value these spaces are very layered, but they are also dependent on what they gravitate to. And that could even involve sports as well. So the benefit is also dependent on what that person values in the short.
Okay, so when you think about public planning for optimal public health, how is a community supposed to decide what to do with that property? Because you can't do all of those things, and some of them making, specially designing like playing fields with all the drainage requirements and everything is going to be a different kind of expense and a different kind of maintenance than if you just sort of have a wild natural park, right? So, given that everybody in a community might have individual desires and wants and needs, what is the recommendation for urban planners?
Well, I will say I'm not an urban planner, but when it does come to the context of how, public spaces are managed, I think you speak to a very salient point in the sense of why authentic engagement with the community on the onset is rather it is rather very important because there are different interests that come into play, but when the value of this space is connected to needs as well as different preferences that are within that community. It's a conversation that can be a bit more two-way instead of a bit directional with other agendas and concerns.
And, space is limited in urban settings, which is one of the things that you focus on. Have you seen any successful reclamation projects where a city, in retrospect, decides they'd like to have fewer parking lots and more green space?
Well, yes, there's an article that I wrote in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health. And in that particular piece, we talk about how green spaces can connect to different dimensions of health equity, being everyone having the opportunity to achieve optimal health.
Okay.
And in that one, we highlighted different organizations that reclaimed or set aside that particular green space for different needs that they had in their community. That may have been a space to facilitate environmental education and science education amongst young people in their community. It may have been in the sense of having a community garden where people could not only meet their residents, but also have a source of food and, you know, fruits and vegetables. So there have been different organizations that are doing that across the country.
Tell me more about the inequities that you've found when it comes to access to green space.
Well, there have been some mixed results with this because they can vary, but I've been involved in a few projects that explore this very question. For example, we synthesized literature on urban green spaces and gaps in health, also known as health disparities. And we found that unequal access to green spaces were related to these reoccurring themes in health disparities, particularly as it relates to conditions such as obesity, cardiovascular disease, psychological health, and heat-related illness. And That's a conversation that continues to play out.
Now, couldn't those things be more the result of lack of access to healthy food, affordable food options, or lack of access to healthcare? Why make the leap and say, hey, they don't have enough parks in their community, therefore obesity, poor mental health?
Well, I'm careful, you know, to not make it in the sense of causation. Mm-hmm. And I'm very clear and cautious and mindful to say that green spaces are only one variable in a much larger equation of factors that impact our health and well-being. That's just my particular area of focus and expertise. But you're right, even in the studies that we have conducted, in some respects, we account for those factors. But as you mentioned, there are a number of factors at play that impact our health and well-being. And from my particular area of work, we focus on the powerful context that place plays in health promotion, and it's also described as place-based health.
Place? What do you mean by place?
Place-based?
Yeah. What does that mean?
Just describing how our place can impact our public health in the sense of these components of social determinants of health being the conditions where we live, where we work, and where we play. You know, the way you perceive your environment and what you have access to can impact what resources are at your disposal, but also how you perceive your health and safety.
What kinds of communities tend to have more of these, tend to have less access to green space?
Well, in my particular area of work, we focus on minority as well as low income communities and look at literature in that particular space. But again, when we look at the breadth of knowledge on this topic, the results can vary.
Sure, because I could think of some very, I imagine in the U.S. and around the world, there are some very expensive high-rise apartment neighborhoods where there's also not a lot of green space. But then I also think of something like Central Park in Manhattan, where the high-rises that surround it are some of the most sought-after property, even if it's just so that you can look out on the park instead of looking out on, more streets and more cars.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the heat-related health problems that green space can address. What does that mean?
Well, there was a document some years ago from the Environmental Protection Agency where they provided a stance in the sense of vegetation being able to buffer what they call the urban heat island effect, which is where there's pretty much an increase in temperature related to impervious surfaces and processes that happen in the urban setting. So with the increase or the presence rather of vegetation, that helps to buffer that effect and help to manage temperatures in cities. So from the context of heat-related illness, that could involve things such as heat stroke and other pressures that are in urban settings. But again, there are other factors that are involved in that particular scenario.
Speaking with Venice Jennings, who studies how green space works in urban settings, she's a professor of public health at Agnes Scott College. Sometimes parks can actually attract crime or other problematic behaviors and are become a place where people don't let their kids go, or a neighborhood wishes they didn't have in their neighborhood. Often that's what are some of the reasons why a park or a green space would become a blight on a community?
Well, one of the things, that's a good question. And one of the points that I mentioned in a recent article that I wrote on social cohesion is that parks are a part of the larger city or social context. So thinking about the background and the social context of that place is pivotal to how people can really interact with one another on these particular green spaces and the potential benefits that they receive. So if it's a high crime area that happens to have this park as well, that challenge can be there. So undergirding the benefits that we can receive from the spaces is very important to address these issues as well, so that people can recreate safely and be treated fairly.
So what would that look like in a neighborhood that is dealing with crime, but that also deserves a park, because those kids, those families need those benefits as well? What does undergirding it so that it can be safe mean?
Well, I've seen, for example, in the health equity paper, we did highlight some research out of New York where a particular community actually worked with law enforcement to have additional patrolling in that particular park. They improved lighting throughout the park to enhance safety, as well as, really mobilizing people in the community to look out for one another in those spaces.
Talk to me a little more about your findings regarding social cohesion or social health. What does green space do in a neighborhood? And then, especially now that we all have to keep 6 feet of distance, I wonder if we no longer get the social cohesion benefits from parks.
No, that's a great question. Well, yes, 2020 has presented a number of factors, different things to think about when it comes to social cohesion. And that mainly pertains to not only the way that people interact with one another, but how people can be mobilized in these spaces and connect with one another during their time there. And in the research with the particular paper that I wrote, we found, again, some reoccurring themes where we identified that a green space has the capacity to help facilitate a sense of place, being, as you mentioned, Central Park, people having a sense of pride or a place where that they can go to recreate. Also, social support was something that we found. Social support is really critical in the larger context of public health because it relates to our ability to have some type of agency and connection with other people. So we found that, for example, some parks have friends of the parks groups, or they may have other social connections or ties or groups related to these green spaces that has helped people to develop different communities that they can tap into. Also, we found belonging and empowerment to be other pathways that green spaces can support that dimension of social cohesion.
Venice Jennings is an environmental researcher and professor of public health at Agnes Scott College. She's one of the authors of a book called Urban Green Spaces. Thanks a lot for your time, Professor.
Thank you.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, a look at why President Trump is so concerned about TikTok. I'm Julie Rose. Thank you for tuning into Top of Mind today. TikTok, the wildly popular lip sync and dance video app, is in trouble from the Trump administration. The trouble is that TikTok is owned by a Chinese company called ByteDance, which is based in Beijing. So President Trump is worried China could use the app to spy on Americans, and he has threatened to ban it soon. But over the weekend, Microsoft confirmed that it's in talks to buy TikTok and move all the private data of American users to the U.S., where it would be out of reach of Chinese authorities. If that goes through, it could ease the president's concerns. Just before Microsoft entered the picture on all of this last week, I spoke with cybersecurity expert Zach Doffman about TikTok and the national security threats it poses. Let's listen. For those of us who don't use TikTok, and I'm in that category, what kind of information does it get from me when I install the app?
TikTok's a lightweight social media platform. So in the main, the information it has from you is about the phone on which you are accessing the app. So it knows the device you're on and details about who you are and your number and such. But then it can also track, you know, the videos that you like, the friends that you interact with on TikTok. I guess it can infer the preferences that you have. Exactly the same kind of information that Facebook or Instagram or YouTube or any of those other social media platforms will be able to get about you. There's no proven or no evidence that TikTok is doing anything to circumvent the protections on your iPhone or your Android device to access the camera or the microphone or anything like that.
And location information, would it be tracking my whereabouts?
So many apps are able to ping your location, and TikTok will be one of those. So it will be able to know where you are when you access the app. But countless apps look for that kind of information. And when you talk about the monetization of mobile kind of cell phone information, location is really kind of primary data source, if you like. You've seen Apple and Google crack down on this recently in terms of people pinging your location all of the time. But when you're within an app, then it can certainly do that.
Okay, so it sounds to me like you're saying that TikTok is just like all the other apps that are super popular right now that people use. And when you download TikTok, you're going to be giving it information just like you give Facebook and Instagram and YouTube information. So really the only wrinkle here is that TikTok's parent company is Chinese?
Well, I think it's a really great question. It is the question, isn't it? And social media is very invasive. I think we all know that. We've seen the trials and tribulations Facebook has been through in the last 2 years following the Cambridge Analytica scandal. And if you like, what that showed is the power of seemingly innocuous information at scale and what a social media platform or its partners can do with that information. So there's no evidence that TikTok is doing any more than just gathering that kind of data. In fact, it gathers a lot less than Facebook, just given it's a narrower social media platform. But you're absolutely right. The issue is that it's owned by a Chinese corporation that is clearly subject to the laws in China, just as Facebook and Google are subject to laws in the US. And whatever TikTok is doing today, the clear fear is that it may do something different in the future, or that it may be used by the Chinese authorities to gather information. Now, there's no evidence that it's done that up until now, but clearly there's no guarantee that it's not going to do that in the future.
Okay, let me just be clear here. So TikTok is not owned and run by the Chinese government. It's a Chinese company that is the parent company of TikTok. But the key difference here is that in China, the Chinese communist government has a lot of power and sway over Chinese companies. And so the concern is that if the Chinese government at some point wanted information on all the millions of Americans or Australians or whoever is using TikTok, that they could potentially go to TikTok and say, TikTok's parent company, and say, you're a Chinese company, we're your government, give us your information.
Yeah, in a nutshell. TikTok, if there are lots of parallels have been drawn between TikTok and Huawei, which is the Chinese 5G equipment and smartphone manufacturer that's been the headline act, if you like, of the Trump administration's blacklist against Chinese technologies. And one of the allegations that's been made against Huawei is that it is controlled by the Chinese government, because Huawei has a quite non-transparent ownership structure. It's owned by its employees, it says, but in quite a complex way. ByteDance is the parent company of TikTok, and that's very different. It's a typical startup, a kind of a fast growth tech startup, albeit it's based in Beijing. And although it has international investors, it's clearly subject to the laws of the country in which it's based. And there is some evidence that the management of ByteDance have in the past, you know, adapted some of their behavior or changed things because they've been put under pressure by the Chinese government. TikTok has been at pains to distance itself from China. So It's not used in China. It's if you like ByteDance's application outside of China. TikTok says it doesn't store any of its data in China. It won't give data on its users to the Chinese government if they ask, et cetera, et cetera. It has a CEO, a US CEO, who's clearly was put in place to kind of add to the transparency. It has a US chief security officer, and just this week, the CEO has kind of has offered to make public elements of the algorithm that's used to kind of show you the various videos that you see. Something that certainly the likes of Facebook, Google, and others have not done. So TikTok is at pains to distance itself from Beijing. It is still owned by a Chinese company, and that, unfortunately, there's not a lot they can do about that absent kind of selling the company or relocating the company to a different country.
Okay.
And we saw something really interesting in Hong Kong a few weeks ago. So Hong Kong introduced a new national security law at the turn of the year. So until then, Hong Kong's national security regulations or laws, if you like, had been slightly different to China. So it was separate. And what happened turn of the month is that they kind of became more seamless, which gave the mainland Chinese authorities more access to information around citizens in Hong Kong and the ability to punish those citizens for dissent, which they hadn't had before. And what you saw at the time was lots of US social media platforms, the likes of Twitter and Facebook and others, saying that they wouldn't cooperate with the Chinese authorities if asked. They wouldn't, if you like, adhere to the new national security law, whatever the implications of that was. And then ByteDance did something really interesting. What ByteDance said is actually TikTok was going to exit the Hong Kong market. And at the time, that kind of got lost in amongst all of the other announcements coming from the different US and international social media platforms. But it was actually much more interesting than that, because what TikTok was saying is it couldn't take the same approach as a Google and Facebook and just ignore requests because it's a Chinese company. And therefore, all it could do, it had to exit Hong Kong, because otherwise it would put itself in a very difficult position
of
and
being
reputationally.
of having to potentially hand over information. So if the Chinese government said, "Hey, this TikTok user in Hong Kong is posting stuff that's inflammatory or that we think is a threat to national security," ByteDance and TikTok would be hard pressed to deny the Chinese government that. Whereas Twitter and Google and Facebook are saying, "Hey, we're just gonna, shut the door on the Chinese government. We're not gonna abide by this." But this Chinese company was not able to guarantee that, so they've instead said, "No Hong Kongers can use TikTok. We're just gonna protect ourselves that way."
Exactly. Now, clearly, they haven't come out and said that, but when you stand back and look at it, that's clearly the implication
Interesting.
Of what happened. Hong Kong's not a big market for TikTok or anyone, actually. It's not a particularly large territory. So it wasn't a difficult commercial decision. But TikTok, the real risk for TikTok is that the guarantees it's made to not give data to the Chinese authorities and the data isn't stored in Beijing, it can't see any of those guarantees compromised. And clearly, a citizen in Hong Kong using the non-Chinese application TikTok would have potentially put it in that risky position.
I'm speaking with Zach Doffman, who is a cybersecurity expert contributor to Forbes.com, talking about TikTok, which has come under increased scrutiny. It's super popular and has especially become popular during the pandemic. Lots of these little viral dance videos and lip sync videos. Comedians are using it. And the Trump administration and Congress have been talking more and more about wanting to restrict it or ban it because its parent company is Chinese and could come under pressure from the Chinese government. How would a ban actually work, Zach Doffman? How do you prevent people from having access to an app in a free market like the United States or the UK?
Great question. Again, what's really interesting is obviously China has taken the great firewall approach. So the irony of the whole TikTok issue is all of the US equivalents are banned in China. There's no Facebook, there's no YouTube, there's no Instagram, there's no Twitter. Those applications are all banned. But clearly, the US and Europe absolutely doesn't want to go down that road. It doesn't want to create a firewall. It doesn't want to be seen to be censoring or limiting media. So specifically with TikTok, what would happen is, in all likelihood, if the US did choose to exercise a ban, is that it would be added to the entity list, which is held by the Commerce Department and is the same sanction that's been used against Huawei. And what that would do is it would restrict any American companies from selling services to or buying services from TikTok. And that would make it very difficult for TikTok to be on the App Store or on the Play Store. It would be difficult for it to use US domicile cloud service providers to buy US hardware. So the US wouldn't ban it per se. It would restrict American organizations from working with it, with which in essence would have the same effect to restrict US citizens' access to the technology.
Is the United States really the only country? I mean, TikTok is huge globally, as I understand it, except for in China. Is the United States the only country that's concerned about this, this security risk?
Not at all. I mean, this, if you like, the first party on the banning TikTok was India. India is TikTok's largest market by user numbers, and it makes a lot of money there. India, as you know, has got a kind of a military political series of tensions with China right now. They've had border skirmishes, and the Indian authorities banned a whole raft of different Chinese applications, including things like WeChat, so very popular other applications a month or so ago, just before Mike Pompeo actually came out and was the first kind of member of the Trump administration to talk about the potential for a ban. We've seen lots of pressure in Australia as well, which, given its geography, has a tension with China as well, of its own, a regional tension. You may have seen a couple of months ago, there were allegations that the Chinese had that the Chinese have been responsible for various cyber attacks against Australian government organizations and politicians. So you've seen pockets of resistance, if you like, around the world. The issue for TikTok is clearly the America is America. It is the home of social media, and TikTok's greatest success over the last year or so has been to compete and outcompete the likes of Instagram and YouTube and others in America. And it's played the influencer game. In essence, it's growing faster than these US applications. If it loses access to the US, it will lose access to US influencers. And in essence, people will move on to Reels or something else. And that for TikTok has huge international implications, far beyond the 40, 50 million users it has in America.
Zach Dofman, you are a cybersecurity expert. Your expertise in particular is geopolitics and cybersecurity and counterterrorism. In your opinion, how much of the concern over TikTok, whether in India or the United States or anywhere else, is about bigger political, international politics concerns, you know, between the United States and China, for example, and the trade war and the tensions over, you know, hacking and other things that are going on? And how much of this is actually really rooted in a fear that somehow China could get really important information about us by spying on us through TikTok?
It's an interesting balance. To come to the second part of your statement first, I think there's a kind of a misunderstanding of when people talk about the threat of TikTok, the idea that they're hoovering up information on hundreds of millions of people and it's ending up in a basement in Beijing, and that's of huge value to the Chinese. It's clearly not like that. There's very little information that you as a user of TikTok are going to provide that's interesting in Beijing. What there is you've got the application in your pocket, and it's a source of news, and they can feed you that news, and they can also get a fairly good sense of who you know, what you like, what you don't like, what your tastes and your preferences are. And we live in a world of disinformation and misinformation where if I want to feed you a particular narrative, social media is a great place to do that. And clearly the young user base of an app like TikTok is one could argue quite impressionable. So if you take something like the origins of coronavirus, clearly a fantastic narrative opportunity there if you own the platform to try to pump particular messages out. Now, again, no proven evidence that TikTok's done that, but you can kind of see where the threat might lie.
So you think the real power then, or the real risk with TikTok being owned by the Chinese is simply that the Chinese government could use it as a propaganda tool?
I think again, focusing on the real stuff, I think in the right now, there are two risks. The risk is one of misinformation or disinformation, and also that you can amortize a lot of information. So you can, you know, if you wanted to know in a particular district in New York what people thought, where they were leaning, what stories they were looking at, what comments they were making, you could clearly analyze that information, which is exactly what Facebook does to work out what you're likely to buy or how you might vote. And it could draw the same conclusions. But it's on the tangible stuff, there's a broader point as well. You know, if you go back to the early years of Facebook, it didn't do most of what it does today. So clearly, if TikTok has a billion users, it can launch lots of new services and apps on the top of that user base, exactly as Facebook and others have done. And we don't know what they may be. So there's obviously a risk that TikTok could monetize its user base or provide different types of applications and services to all of those people that it doesn't today. But I think let's not lose sight of what you said first, which is absolutely right. Look, there's a broad standoff between the US and China. Technology is right at the forefront of it. We have the Chinese talking about a potential new internet. We have the Huawei situation in the US and across Europe and more widely as well. And the TikTok thing has been caught up in that. And what's really interesting about TikTok is, unlike, say, Huawei or ZTE or the surveillance companies that have also been sanctioned or have been sanctioned, TikTok's a social media platform. It's much more lightweight. It doesn't have the same critical infrastructure potential. But it's raised the question that's never been posed before, which is, how does the US deal with a social media platform that's owned by an adversarial state? We saw a little bit of that with FaceApp, if you remember, a year or so ago, which was, you know, a Russian app that became very viral very quickly.
Oh, right. That showed you what you would look like when you were old.
Clearly. Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. So again, there was all, you'll remember, there was, you know, the senators were up in arms. It created the same kind of flash reaction that we're seeing right now. It was Russian. And again, we saw the developers behind FaceApp denying that the data was all in Russia and it was being used to train AI, and there was facial recognition. All kinds of stuff came out then. So you're seeing something similar, but TikTok is a much bigger deal. It's clearly, you know, it is the soar away success of lockdown. Its user numbers are staggering. And, you know, you have to be of a certain age. Clearly, you kind of get above 30 and it becomes a little bit of a mystery. But, you know, people are addicted to it. They are. It's so bite-sized and viral. It has absolutely nailed the way to attract the attention of that user group. And therefore, they're spending a lot of time on it. And that does put the app and its developers in a very powerful position.
Zach Doffman is a cybersecurity expert, CEO of Digital Barriers, a security firm, and contributor at Forbes.com. We taped that conversation late last week, just before President Trump stepped up his threat to ban TikTok, and Microsoft announced it's in talks to purchase the app's U.S. operations. Microsoft has until September 15th to come up with an acquisition deal that will alleviate national security concerns over TikTok, or we may yet still see a ban. Tuesday afternoon on Top of Mind, a family genealogy of Yellowstone's wolves is the reality nature drama you didn't know you needed. So much intrigue and dysfunction, and it's all up on Ancestry.com with photos and family charts and personal anecdotes. We'll meet one of the founders of the Yellowstone Wolf Genealogy Project Tuesday afternoon on Top of Mind, 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, or the free BYU Radio app. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. First this hour, how World War II and the assassination of JFK led to a major rewrite of U.S. immigration laws. And the problem of overusing antibiotics and causing drug-resistant bacteria is not just among humans and animals. Plants have the same problem. Also, what's a bumblebee colony to do if it's ready to feed and can't find any plants in bloom? Well, they bite. That's ahead on Top of Mind. Thanks for tuning in. President Trump talks frequently of wanting to end chain migration. Another word for it is family reunification. And it has been a central focus of U.S. immigration policy since the 1960s. Now, the irony is that it was created as a policy to appease nativist members of Congress who hoped to see white Europeans make up the majority of future immigrants to America. But the plan backfired on them and helped to fuel streams of immigrants over the years from Asia, Africa, the Middle East, and South America. It's what made it possible for Jia Lin Yang to be born in the United States. Yang is deputy national editor at the New York Times and author of a new book about immigration in America. It's called One Mighty and Irresistible Tide. And she joins me now. Jia Lin Yang, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here.
What is your family's immigrant story?
My parents came for education in the late 60s and early 70s, and they came on student visas, but then they were able to stay because our immigration system since 1965 gives priority to people with family already here and people with special skills. And so my mom, who studied microbiology, was able to stay for that reason. And over the years, you know, our entire family is here now. My mom's siblings, their spouses, they all had children, my cousins out in California. So piece by piece, our whole extended family from Taiwan was able to really settle in the U.S. and, you know, have families and really build very full lives here.
What did that story mean to you growing up?
I think I took it for granted, honestly. You know, I knew that there was this mythology around America as a nation of immigrants. And, you know, we had allowed so many people from Europe to come. And growing up in Northern Virginia, where I'm sitting right now, my friends were from other parts of the world, too. I had friends from Afghanistan, from Iran, all over. And so I honestly just thought, you know, it's a nation of immigrants, so we've always allowed people to come. And it wasn't until I started really digging into this history that I realized just how unlikely it is, in fact, that my family was allowed to be here and that it wasn't something that was ever a given for me and my parents and for many other families from around the world.
The laws that made it possible for your parents to come here as students and then to stay on and then to bring over other family members went into effect in the 1960s. Just describe for us what was going on that led to such a large immigration package being passed in 1965.
So this is LBJ's presidency, and he is passing all kinds of very, very ambitious legislation, right? This is the period of time where we see the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the creation of Medicare and Medicaid, all these parts of what Johnson called the Great Society. And immigration was a piece of this. And at the time, you know, it didn't attract a ton of attention, even from LBJ himself. It was something that was kind of left over from JFK's administration, in fact. And it was really the culmination of 40 years of trying to really reshape the immigration system. Mm. So the thing to understand is that before this law was passed, there was really a very rigid system of ethnic quotas. And Congress back in the 20s.
Ethnic quotas. Literally, we can have X number of people from this ethnicity every year coming to the United States.
Yes. And these were laws passed in the 1920s as kind of a backlash to the huge numbers of immigrants that we saw coming here between 1880 and 1920. This is a period of just massive change in cities like New York because there's so many Eastern European Jews coming, there are Italians coming. You know, I think we think of like Little Italy in downtown New York or like Little Italy's around the country. This is when they're really starting up. Mm. And people got very concerned. They thought these immigrants seem really different from the Americans who were here before, right? We are a nation of immigrants from Northwestern Europe. We're English. We don't know what these people who are Jewish and Catholic, we don't know what to do with them. And so they passed laws in the 20s that heavily restricted them. And they had these ethnic quotas that literally ranked different ethnicities by how much we wanted people here. So we said, we want people from England. We don't want people from Italy or Russia. And we definitely don't want people from Asia. And we don't want people from Africa and so on and so forth. And so by the time
let's pause on that for a moment.
Yeah.
When those laws were passed in the 1920s, were they publicly popular?
They were very popular because it seemed normal. You know, it was a period of time. I think we think of the 20s. At least I was taught the 20s in high school as like the jazz age. There's, you know, there's women dancing the Charleston. What was going on, though, too, was like a lot of xenophobia, a lot of fear of communism at the time, a big red scare, a fear of radicals. There was a lot of anti-Black racism during this time, too. Mm-hmm. And so it was a very isolationist period. And so
and eugenic science,
a
as
lot
well
of eugenic science. Yes.
This whole idea that
you could study people's. You could break all of humankind down to all these different races and ethnicities and say, well, these people are more likely to be, you know, criminals. These people are more likely to be mentally ill. And it was truly treated as a science. And so with all this behind it, it seemed perfectly reasonable to say, hey, America is a Protestant white nation, and we just can't have these people coming in who are different from that. In fact, threatens our democracy, the stability of our entire, you know, project in this political effort to be a democracy, right? Mm. And so it seemed rational at the time to do that. And in fact, it was so rational that the system of ethnic quotas really built on this idea that some, you know, races are superior to others, lasted through the 60s until the 65 law that you and I are talking about now. And so it was an effort that JFK really got behind. Many presidents tried to get rid of this ethnic quota system and they failed, but LBJ ultimately was able to abolish it and basically put in place the system that we have now, more or less.
You feature in your book a number of members of Congress and activists who start trying right from the 1920s, from when these quotas were passed, they are trying to somehow roll them back or get rid of them. As you mentioned, it'll take 40 years to actually succeed. But tell us about some of these prominent activists. Manny Seller, for example.
Manny Seller is one of these people who was, you know, so powerful in his time, fairly well known, and yet, you know, very few people have heard of him now. So he's in Congress for a very long time, from the 20s up through Nixon's administration. And so he's one of the longest serving members of Congress in American history.
Representing what? What?
He's from Brooklyn. Okay. So he's the grandson of German Jewish immigrants. He's born and raised in Brooklyn. His constituents are all immigrants too. This is a time when he enters Congress, this is a moment where Brooklyn is really kind of becoming what it is now. It's becoming really heavily populated, and all these immigrants, especially Jews and Italians, are settling in Brooklyn. And so when he enters Congress, these quotas that I was just describing are passed, and he's horrified because they seem, and they are, discriminatory against the people that he represents and people like he and his family. And so he really spends the next 40 years trying to abolish them. And, you know, for me, a really dramatic point of the story for him is when it's World War II and there's this incredibly, you know, just very dire refugee crisis, especially people trying to flee the Holocaust, later after the war, survivors of the Holocaust, trying to just settle somewhere where they can feel safe and protected. And because of the ethnic quotas, it's really, really tough for the U.S. to help these refugees. And so he sees things like this with more and more horror. And yet, but when we get to the 60s, though, he lives long enough and is in Congress long enough to see these quotas removed.
Tell us about another activist who stuck with this issue uphill on this battle for 40 years.
I also think of somebody like Herbert Lehman. He was the first Jewish governor of New York. And he actually, to me, has like a great footnote in American history because he was FDR's lieutenant governor. So FDR really made his mark as a political leader, first as governor of New York before he reached the White House. And Herbert Lehman was his sort of deputy. And he really, you know, made it possible for FDR to be governor of New York because FDR was suffering from polio and Lehman really stepped forward and helped him do the job. Lehman later entered Congress in his 70s and he too, you know, descended from German Jewish immigrants, very concerned about these ethnic quotas. And in the 50s, he really tries to fight them when it's really hard. Like no one's talking about immigration in the 1950s. Everyone just thinks these quotas are it. This is our system. There's no point in changing them. And he really in the Senate, not single-handedly, but was among the very, very few to speak up to end the quotas and also against McCarthyism, which had, you know, tons of anti-Semitic tones to it. And so he becomes someone who doesn't actually, unfortunately, live to see 1965 law passed. He dies right before it. But he's someone where in that long stretch where no one really believes that it can be done, no reform is possible, he's still fighting that battle.
Speaking with Jia Lin Yang, who's deputy national editor at the New York Times, author of a new book called One Mighty and Irresistible Tide, The Epic Struggle Over American Immigration, 1924 to 1965. You write that the assassination of JFK, John F. Kennedy Jr., plays an important role in the ultimate passage of this immigration bill, the overturning of the quotas in the 1965 Act. What happened? Why was JFK's death part of the story here?
Every president up to this point, including JFK himself, Truman, then JFK, everyone, you know, knows that they want to abolish these ethnic quotas, but they just can't get it through. And JFK faces a similar challenge. His White House comes up with a bill to send to Congress to abolish the quotas and put in a new system. And it's like going nowhere. And a lot of his legislative agenda, frankly, at that point is kind of going nowhere. And then, you know, he's assassinated in November 1963, and LBJ steps in, and LBJ, of course, is incredibly savvy about legislative maneuvering, how to get your way on Capitol Hill because of his history as a Senate Majority Leader for the Democrats before he's vice president. And he basically takes JFK's unfinished legislative agenda and uses, in a very savvy way, again, like the grief of the country to say, you know what, the way to honor this martyred president is to pass his legislative agenda. And so as part of that, immigration is passed and it's pushed through. And after years of having it rejected, you know, it goes through fairly easily. Although, you know, the interesting part, which you've alluded to already, is that in the debate, people are still nervous about kind of letting the foot off the brake of ethnic controls. And so
people, meaning members of Congress, or is the public itself also like caring about this? Or are they just so consumed by the civil rights movement and the other big legislation that's getting passed that they're not really paying attention to the immigration issue?
You know, they're not really paying attention to it. And the thing to think about, too, is these quotas I've described were so effective that they really cut off a lot of immigration. And so even the idea of there being a lot of immigrants, it just wasn't a thing in America, because by this point, the percentage of foreign-born people in the country just kept getting lower and lower and lower because older immigrants would die, frankly. Mm. And so,
and it had been years and years since Immigration Island was even a thing.
Yes. Yeah. Ellis Island was closed, yeah. Right? The whole thing was just like, oh, that's from our past, right? We let in all these Jews and Italians and Irish, and now we're all just one kind of America. And people didn't even discuss immigration really as like a, you know, it's hard to imagine now because it's such a hot button issue. It's always in the news. But at this time, there weren't many immigrants. And it just seemed like not that big a deal. And for the people who were behind it, you know, they were trying to correct the wrongs of the past in their view. They were trying to get rid of this law from the 1920s, which seemed offensive to Jews and Italians. That's how they were thinking about it. And so they weren't really, you know, the debate at the time, there were some people saying, well, when you pass this law, it could really let in different people. And everyone who is for it practically said, no, 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 no. This is not going to really change the country dramatically. You know, LBJ himself, when he signed it, he said, this is not a revolutionary bill. It's righting a past wrong. And of course, you know, you think about the moment, it seems like a civil rights issue too, right? Because by getting rid of these ethnic quotas, the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act says, we will not discriminate when we're giving out visas, right, to immigrants. We will not discriminate based on your race or ethnicity, which is very much in keeping with the spirit of the time, right? Of getting rid of Jim Crow laws, ending segregation, you know, restoring voting rights.
So was it going to be based on first come, first serve instead, or like just
random lottery? So they had to come up with a whole new system, right? So you're going to get rid of the ethnic quota. So how do you decide then who can come in? And so they basically say, you know, we'll have an overall numerical limit, but beyond that, we care about if you have family already here, if you have, you know, direct family, if you have a sibling or a parent or a child already here, you get top priority. Second priority goes to people with special skills, people like my mom. So if you have a technical skill or an advanced degree in science, we want you. And so this is the system they put in place. And unbeknownst to them, the future of American immigration past 1965 is not European. In fact, by the early 1970s, the number of immigrants from Asia is already surpassing the number from Europe. And people begin to realize, oh my goodness, this law, which really is about racial equality for sure as a principle, this law is actually changing the demographics of the country in ways that we did not anticipate. Mm,
so it backfires partly, it backfires on the members of Congress who wanted to see America continue to be as white as possible. It backfires on them partly because they just underestimated the extent to which Europeans would still want to keep coming here. And also because they didn't expect so many people from places like Taiwan, like your mother, would want to come on these highly skilled visas. And then once they're here, then the doors open to their family reunifying with them.
Exactly. So over time, this is why it's called chain migration. And it was called that before the Trump administration called it that, too. That was actually a fairly normal, neutral term to describe it as. And so people's whole extended families come. At the same time, we have a lot of kind of Cold War era refugee policies, which is where we get so many Cuban immigrants, right? We have a lot of Vietnamese immigrants after the Vietnam War. So there are all these different ways that we're bringing in people from outside Europe. And with this chain migration, you know, larger and larger numbers start coming. And so when we talk about the demographic future of America being very different and being much less white, you really can't talk about that without thinking about this 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I don't think it's complicated, right? It's like when I learned that this law hadn't fully intended for my family, people like my family, to be here, you know, that was sort of a confusing thing to realize. But I do go back to the fundamental principle of the law, which I think someone like Manny Seller would absolutely still stand by if we could, you know, if he were alive today. I don't think somebody like him would be horrified at what had happened, because he was all about racial equality or immigration laws. He did not want to control America's racial makeup through immigration. To him, immigrants were the lifeblood of the country. They were just a really important part of our culture, and that should be a celebrated thing. It shouldn't be restricted.
So how did writing this book affect you? You mentioned that it was difficult for you to get your head around the fact that the law hadn't necessarily intended to embrace you and your family with open arms. Has it changed the way you feel about your own status as an American child of Taiwanese immigrants?
Absolutely. I think when you begin to learn the history of our immigration laws, you can't help but realize how arbitrary they can be. You know, we get so caught up in these categories of who's legal, who's illegal, what visa are you on? And we forget that 100 years ago, we didn't have visas. We barely had passports. People just showed up and they were here. And we barely turned anyone away from Ellis Island. And we certainly barely deported people. And so this whole infrastructure of laws and who gets what visa, who's on what waiting list, that's really kind of a modern creation of the 20th century. And I think once you begin to see that, you realize that the reason that, you know, any given family is here is, again, somewhat arbitrary, right? It's like your family got to have these pieces of paper that let you stay and others don't. And so the difference between you and the person who doesn't have the papers, to me, gets a little bit thin. And in fact, if you look at the history of immigration and citizenship around the world, you know, I can't help but think about German Jews in the 1920s and 30s, thinking they had the right papers, but overnight being told, you know, actually, you're no longer a citizen of the state. You're a stateless refugee, and overnight they're refugees. And that's kind of, you know, that's kind of extreme, but I think it's just important to look at the sort of legal underpinnings of what we mean when we say you're legal or illegal, and to understand that that can be changed. That is always up for debate. It's been something before. It was changed. It was changed again. It's a thing that can be changed by other people. And these categories are actually very much not set in stone. And so for me, knowing that is actually very helpful, because I feel like I have a sense of almost political genealogy for why my family is here at all. And I think I feel a sort of sense of humility about anyone trying to navigate this very complicated system, just to know that my family happened to benefit from it, but we just as easily might not have.
Jialin Yang is deputy national editor at the New York Times, author of the new book, One Mighty and Irresistible Tide, The Epic Struggle Over American Immigration from 1924 to 1965. Thank you for taking time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes, why bumblebees sometimes bite plant leaves. Just ahead, you've probably heard by now that the livestock industry uses a lot of antibiotics on chickens and cows. Did you know antibiotics are also widely used on plants?
You're listening to Top of Mind. I'm Ciara Hewlett. We know it's not good for humans to use too many antibiotics because bacteria can develop a resistance, but what about plants? Yes, plants use antibiotics too. Farmers around the world spray these drugs onto their crops in vast quantities, and we still don't know what the consequences could be for human health. A team at the Center for Agriculture and Bioscience International just published some new research on this. Robert Reeder is a senior plant pathologist there, and he's on the line. Welcome.
Hello there.
And Phil Taylor is also with the center doing European support. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Dr. Taylor, why would farmers put antibiotics on plants?
Well, just the same way as antibiotics kill bacteria in people, they kill bacteria in plants, and plants are no different. Plants get bacterial diseases, and antibiotics are a a good remedy for those diseases. So in that regard, they're extremely useful and a sensible thing for farmers to do. Obviously, there's a lot more to it, but on the face of it, it seems like a sensible thing to do.
What kind of antibiotics are they using? The same kind that we humans use?
Well, yes. Some of the ones they use are medically important ones: streptomycin, tetracycline, gentamicin. But then there are some others which are exclusively used in agriculture, such as cusugamycin. Well, this is what we found anyway.
And how much are they using on these plants?
Well, we found in our survey they're using an awful lot more than we thought they were using, because it came as a bit of a shock that anyone was using antibiotics at all. So that we found in certain locations and on certain crops, up to 10% of the recommendations which we were looking at contained an antibiotic on certain crops.
And Robert Reeder, do we know that these crops that they're using this on, is it always for bacterial infection, or are there other things going on there too?
Well, again, this is something that was quite surprising from the data we were looking at. We were seeing that there was an awful lot of antibiotics being applied to crops in Southeast Asia, and particularly on rice. And it wasn't always against bacterial diseases. Often we were seeing that antibiotics were being used when insects or sometimes fungal diseases were also being picked up. So that in itself was a little surprising. We're unsure why this is happening. It could be that the advisors are unaware of how antibiotics work, or we suspect it's probably that they're applying them almost like a tonic to protect the plants against bacteria, and they're mixing them in with fungicides and also insecticides at the same time.
So almost sometimes a preventative measure. They're not sick, but hopefully these antibiotics will stop them from getting sick.
That's correct, yes.
Does that actually work?
Well, to a fashion, it would work. I mean, antibiotics are active on the surface of the plant, and if a bacterium cell was to land there, they help to prevent infection in that respect. Certainly, once a bacterium has got into a plant, these antibiotics have very little effect whatsoever.
Dr. Taylor, you were a farmer. Do you think where are these farmers getting these ideas from? Is this and that they're using tons, like literal tons of antibiotics? Where is this coming from?
Well, I think in certain parts of the world, the antibiotics are considered to be part of the arsenal that farmers use against diseases. So they're not getting them from the chemist shop and grinding up little tablets. These are products which are designed for plants, and they're applying them to their crops.
Robert Reeder, is there any problem, though, with using antibiotics on plants, even if the plant doesn't even have infection? Could they become resistant, just like humans could, and that could cause problems in the future, that these antibiotics won't be able to be used for what they actually should be used for?
Yeah, well, of course, that's the big concern with antibiotic use in agriculture, in veterinary science, and also in plant science as well, that bacteria are very good at transferring information between each other, genetic information, and that if a bacteria becomes resistant to a particular antibiotic, there is a chance that it can confer that resistance onto other bacteria from different species, and ultimately possibly lead to antibiotic resistance in humans.
In humans?
In humans. It's a bit of a murky area at the moment. There's a lot more research that needs to be done. Certainly in the veterinary arena, they have come to the conclusion that the use of antibiotics routinely in animals is a bad thing, and it does lead to resistance, which can lead to antibiotic resistance in organisms that can affect humans. And certainly within the plant arena, there is a lot more research to be done in this area. And we know that these bacteria do pick up these resistance genes, and they do pass them on to other bacteria that they come into contact with.
How could it cause problems for humans? Is it because these antibiotics are getting spread on, sprayed onto these crops, and then that's creating a bacterial resistance, and then we eat the plants that had the antibiotics spread on them, and then somehow that's causing a problem for us?
It's the way that these bacteria will swap genes between each other. So you can have one particular bacteria which is in the environment, and they are quite happy to transfer information between each other. And it could be that this takes place in the gut after it's been ingested, or it could be in the general environment if they come across something which could potentially be infectious to humans. So there is a potential risk which does need a great deal more research.
Okay, so it's that we could be ingesting bacteria that's already become resistant to antibiotics. And since they're using the same a lot of the same antibiotics that humans use, then we have a problem.
That's the general idea. And there is as a concern that the huge amounts of these antibiotics are being sprayed on certain crops against certain pests and diseases. And particularly in the developing world, there's very little information about how much antibiotics are being used and the certain crops that they're being used on.
I'm speaking with Robert Reeder and Phil Taylor. They both work at the Center for Agriculture and Bioscience International, and they just did a study about how antibiotics are being used with plants. Dr. Taylor, you said that you were surprised at the amount of antibiotics being used around the world in the study that you guys did. Why did that surprise you? Do we not know how much these are being used?
Yes, we don't know, I think is the short answer. When you look at the literature, the scientific literature, and you try to assess based on that how much antibiotics are being used on crops, the only real literature that you can find is the use of antibiotic streptomycin and tetracycline on apples and pear trees in North America. And there is very little evidence that it's being used elsewhere. So the fact that we found a lot of use, which is being unreported in the scientific literature, was a surprise.
So this is something that we just don't know what the effects could be for humans and for plants exactly. And then there's just not a lot of oversight happening anywhere around the world.
Yeah, I think in the whole scheme of trying to combat antibiotic resistance, which is a really important thing for the whole world to tackle, because it's a crisis that we're heading towards very rapidly. I think the use of antibiotics on crop plants is possibly slightly irresponsible, because it will be leading to more resistant bacteria being around, and of course, as Rob said, the chances of those genes reaching a pathogen are therefore that much greater.
Why isn't there more oversight on this? Why don't we know how much antibiotics are being used on crops?
It's a difficult thing to monitor, because farmers are not required to document what chemicals are being used. And of course, each national government has to set its own guidelines. And so it's difficult to keep tabs on what's going on. A trading bloc like the EU, they can have a blanket ban and say no antibiotics are to be used on crops, and that has indeed happened. But other countries, not in trading blocs, they can make up their own rules. And if they want to use antibiotics, then they can and do so. And it's not always reported in the press or in the scientific literature.
Dr. Reeder, what needs to happen to figure out more about how much these are being used around the world, and then how much it's really affecting plants and humans?
Well, this is just a starting point, really. We wanted to raise awareness of the potential issue of antibiotic usage on crops. We believe that there should be more guidelines about the use in the countries, and there should be a lot more monitoring. In a recent study, it was found that only 3% of the countries actually have any form of monitoring antibiotic use on crops. So there needs to be a lot more work on the monitoring
and also in regulating some of these antibiotics. Plus, of course, as mentioned, we don't know enough about the fate of these antibiotics once they're in the environment. There needs to be greater research to find out what is the fate of these antibiotics once they're sprayed onto plants. We simply don't know enough at the moment.
Do we also need to be looking into other options for farmers to control bacterial outbreaks and to use other things other than antibiotics?
For sure. I mean, bacterial control is difficult. Unlike for fungi, where there's lots of different chemical products and lots of different techniques to manage them, bacteria are more difficult. Generally, it comes down to copper and copper-based products, which are the first line of defense. And these are products that you apply onto the plant surface, and they prevent the bacteria from getting into the plant. So that's the first line. There are some other products potentially out there, but particularly with bacteria, it's about making sure your plants are healthy, that there's no wounds, because most bacteria require a wound and water to enter the plant. So it's keeping your plants healthy and keeping them damage-free, and that's your first line of defense. And of course, we've always got genetic resistance as well, so selecting varieties which are more resistant to bacterial infection in the first place.
Phil Taylor, as a former farmer yourself, what do you think needs to be done with farmers? How do they need to be educated more, or is there something that needs to be done there?
It's a very tricky one, because it's not in any one farmer's interest to stop spraying the antibiotics. It's a global or national issue. So any one individual would be effectively punishing themselves if they were to stop using the antibiotics when all of their neighbors are doing so. So it really needs some sort of national regulation of these products, and possibly even an international regulation. So many of the international organizations, the UN, FAO, OECD, they are all deeply concerned about antibiotic overuse. But mostly this is in the sort of animal health arena, and they haven't really picked up on the fact that plants are also receiving large doses of antibiotics. So it will really require some sort of intergovernmental, international collaboration to try and make sure that this the practice isn't too extensive.
Phil Taylor is European support at the Center for Agriculture and Bioscience International. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And Robert Reeder is a senior plant pathologist, also at the same center. Thank you so much for your time as well.
That was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
I'm Ciara Hewlett. This is Top of Mind.
And I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, what is a bumblebee colony to do if it's ready to feed but can't find any plants in bloom nearby? They bite. Thanks for tuning in to Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. It's great to have you along. Nothing good comes of a bee sting, in my opinion. But what about a bee bite? Researchers at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich noticed bumblebees that they study have a habit of biting the leaves of plants. Why, they wondered. Mark Mesker is one of those researchers, and he is on the line with me now to explain what they've found. Professor Mesker, hello. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Good to be here.
What do bees bite with? Do they have teeth in a mouth?
They have mouth parts. So they have a proboscis, and they have mandibles. And the behavior that we actually observed involves both of those. There's kind of a two-part process where they use their proboscis to punch through the leaf, to puncture the leaf, and then they use their mandibles basically to carve out basically these semicircular holes in the leaves.
Oh, it leaves a semicircular hole. Big, little, would it be like the size of a hole punch?
It's about the size of a hole punch. Yeah, it's a very characteristic damage. Once you see it, you recognize it immediately. One of the students was eating a salad the other day and just saw on the leaves this characteristic hole that probably bumblebee damage.
Huh. Bumblebee. Is a bumblebee different from a honeybee?
Yes. So they're quite different. Honeybees have much larger colonies.
And bumblebees are larger, aren't they? Aren't they kind of the big buzzy ones that you'll see?
Yes.
Sometimes.
The workers are quite a bit larger.
Okay. So this leaf biting behavior is something that you have found specific to bumblebees, or do you think all bees do it?
It appears to be specific to bumblebees. So we know that several different species of bumblebees do it because we saw other species of bumblebees besides the ones that we study coming into our experimental plots and damaging plants. But at the same time, we're pretty sure that honeybees don't do this because at the same time when we were doing our experiments, we saw lots of honeybees around, but they basically ignored the plants without flowers that we saw the bumblebees damaging.
Yeah. So how did you first notice that the bees were doing this? Had this not been documented before?
No, it's never been documented in scientific research as far as we can tell. So work in our lab really focuses on communication between species, and we had bumblebees in the lab to look at something entirely different. So we were trying to look at how the presence of herbivores on the plants changes the odors and how that would affect the bumblebees coming in to pollinate the plants. But while we had the bees in the lab, we saw this behavior where they were damaging the leaves. And then that sort of raised the question of what they were doing. And so we set out to investigate that.
Yeah. What was your initial hunch?
So fairly early on, we had this idea that we should look to see whether it was had an effect on flowering time. Because we know from other literature that some kinds of stress can affect flowering time and cause plants to flower earlier. Drought stress, for example, can cause early flowering, some sorts of pathogen infection. So we knew that was a possibility. The other possibility is just that the bees were trying to directly collect something from the leaves.
Like that maybe they were eating it or
maybe something. They were feeding on something. Maybe there were some plants produce extra floral nectar. Maybe there was some secretion or something from the leaf that they were trying to acquire. Hmm. And we can't entirely rule out the possibility that could still be the case. What we observe is that they don't really appear to. So they cut these holes in the leaves, but they don't take the material that they excise back with them to the nest. And we don't really see any evidence that they're feeding on the leaves. It doesn't take them very long to cut these individual holes. So at the same time, we did experiments to see whether there was an effect on flowering time, and we found that there was a quite dramatic effect on flowering time, so that the plants that were damaged by the bees flowered much earlier than plants that were not damaged or plants that we damaged ourselves and tried to mimic the damage that the bees do.
Oh, that's wild. That you actually also made semicircular holes, like you copied the bee behavior, but with a poker, I guess. Did you make
that's
your
right.
own?
That's right. Sort of. We used forceps from the laboratory and razor blades. Yes, and we tried to mimic the bee damage as closely as possible. In fact, for every plant in our mechanical damage control, that we called it, we used a bee-damaged plant as a reference and tried to more or less exactly copy the number of holes and where those holes were placed and so forth.
But you found that the plants that had been damaged, the leaves that had been punched, holes punched in them by the bees, they were not at that point flowering. They were earlier in their flowering cycle, but somehow the bee bites sped up the flowering by 30 days?
That's right, by up to 30 days. But we did it in two different species of plants. We did it in a mustard plant and in tomato plants. And in both cases, there was a dramatic increase. So yes, of
wow.
More than a week, 2 weeks or up to a month.
But when you did it, you were not able to get them to flower as quickly as the bee bites did.
No, there was a small effect of our damage, but it wasn't nearly as dramatic as what the bees did. And there could be two reasons for that. One is it's possible that we're just not able, despite our best efforts, to mimic exactly the damage that the bees are doing. And the other possibility is that there's something more to the cue that the bees are providing to the plant. So if they're doing the damage, but it's possible that there's also a chemical in the saliva of the bees, for example, that's involved in the signaling to the plant. that we don't know about yet. But that's something we'd like to look at in future work.
Do the bumblebees bite the leaves of plants only under certain conditions? Or do they do it all the time, regardless, including when the plants are already flowering?
There's a dramatic difference in the amount of damage they do depending on the availability of floral resources. So we did experiments in the laboratory where we would deprive the bees of pollen, and we found that when they're pollen deprived, they do much more damage to plants than when they're given plenty of pollen. Mm. And then in outdoor experiments, we manipulated the availability of flowers in the local environment. And again, we found that if their flowers are abundant in the local environment, they do very low levels of damage. But when there are no flowers in the local environment, they'll do extensive damage to nearby plants that are not flowering.
What conclusions do you draw from that?
We stop short of saying that the bees that this is an evolutionary adaptation, that the bees are actually doing this to cause the plants to flower. But certainly everything that we've seen so far is consistent with the idea that the bees are doing this when their floral resources are in short supply in the local environment. Mm. And that it brings new flowers online earlier, and that likely benefits the bees. And indeed, we have some evidence from additional experiments that we haven't published yet that showing that the bees actually do benefit from this increase in floral resources that comes online as a result of the damage.
How long does a bumblebee live? Would the bumblebees that are biting the leaves today still be alive to eat the pollen in 3 or 4 weeks?
Probably not. I would guess that the lifespan of an individual worker in the best case is only 2 or 3 weeks. And there's probably a lot of mortality from other sources. So no, it's unlikely that the bees that are doing the damage would be collecting from the flowers that would come. If the time lag between the damage and the flowering is as long as what we saw in our experiments.
I mean, how would an individual bee have evolved to understand that damaging leaves works if individual bees are not benefiting from it?
This is more general puzzle of the evolution of social insects. Because it's the worker bees don't benefit anyway in terms of reproductive success because they're basically sterile and they don't reproduce. And so Darwin noted, Darwin's theory of evolution was explaining adaptation in terms of natural selection, the differential reproduction of individual organisms. And he noted that social insects were a puzzle from that perspective, but he also sort of guessed at what the answer was, which is that it had to do with families. And so even though the individual bumblebee worker in our case that's doing this leaf damaging behavior is not going to be around to benefit from that. Hmm. It's going to benefit the colony and it's going to benefit sisters of that worker that the queen will produce. And ultimately it will lead to the production of new queens that will then carry those same genes. And so it's the contingent manifestation of these genetically influenced behaviors so that the worker does a different, the same gene can have a different effect on worker behavior versus a queen behavior. Just like in our own bodies, the same genes in different cells can have different effects if it's a brain cell, if it's a liver cell, and so forth. And in that way, you really can think of a social insect colony, bumblebee colony or honeybee colony, as sort of a superorganism. They're sort of halfway in between being a larger sort of organism and being a collection of individuals.
Oh, that's interesting. Do you have any reason to believe that this is a new-ish adaptation in bumblebees?
No, it almost certainly isn't because, we've seen it in three different species now, which means it very likely existed before the separation of those species, which I don't know exactly the time frame, but it's likely millions of years.
So it wouldn't be in any way related to a changing climate or the changing cycle of flowering plants in a specific environment.
In the paper, we suggest that it could have implications for the resilience of these plant-pollinator interactions to climate change.
Meaning it could be useful. It could be a useful tool for them, but it probably didn't develop because of climate change.
Right. But to the extent that changes in climate or other environmental disturbances might otherwise cause tend to disrupt the temporal, the timing of these interactions between the bees and the flowers, then this phenomenon where there appears to be sort of a direct interaction and a direct transfer of information from the bees to the plants could tend to make those interactions more robust to such disturbances. Hmm. But we don't think that this is a new adaptation in response to climate change. It may be an adaptation in response in general just to uncertainty. And we discuss whether, you know, is this an adaptation that benefits the bees? It's also possible that it benefits the flowers and it benefits the plants. And it sort of, it could be a mutualism in that sense. So they could be a communication system where there's sort of a mutual agreement that the bees are signaling their presence to the plants and the plants are responding by bringing flowers online.
Why would it benefit the plants?
Well, so the problem that plants have is that they can't, that they're basically stationary, right? They're static. And so they want to do sexual reproduction. They're basically using the insects for pollination to do that. So they provide rewards to the pollinators like bumblebees in the form of nectar, and the pollen itself is nutritious value for them. But from the plant's point of view, what they want is the bees to pick up the pollen in one flower and then deliver it to another flower to fertilize that flower so that they can effectively do sexual reproduction.
I see. So the plant would like to flower at exactly the right moment when the bumblebees are around to do the pollinating for them. And so this could be a way for the bees to say, all right, we're here, let's do this. And then the flowering plants know, okay, now, you know, now's the time for reproduction.
It could be the case. Hmm. Again, that goes beyond what our data, you know, firmly show, but definitely it's possible.
Is there evidence of that kind of mutual signaling in nature, though?
Well, in general, I think the pollinator plant relationship is often mutualistic, is generally mutualistic. I mean, there can be conflict in case, and in some cases, there are plants that are actively deceiving the pollinators, right, rather than producing rewards like nectar and pollen for the pollinators in service for their pollination. They have flowers that mimic a female bee, and they produce an odor that mimics the sex pheromone of the bee, and so they trick pollinators in, and there are other sorts of deception and manipulation that plants can do. But often it's more or less a transaction where the plants are producing nectar and pollen that's rewarding to the bees, and basically it's a mutually beneficial relationship.
Mark Mesker is a professor of evolutionary ecology at ETH Zurich, the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. Thank you very much for taking time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. What is the story with kids and caffeine? Does it really stunt growth? Should you worry if your teen likes energy drinks? How guilty should you feel when you occasionally cave to your 10-year-old's pleas and let him have a Dr. Pepper? Jennifer Temple says the effects of caffeine, she studies the effects of caffeine in kids. She's the director of the Nutrition and Health Research Laboratory at the University of Buffalo. She says the American Academy of Pediatrics believes it's okay for children 12 and older to have caffeine, but the maximum safe dose is roughly 2 cans of soda in a single day. And Temple says, as for a risk of overdose of caffeine, that's rare but possible.
There is a lethal dose of caffeine, but it's very, very high. So for sure, there have been several deaths that have been in the past 5 to 10 years that have been attributed to over-caffeination or to a lethal dose of caffeine. Mm. And there's a couple reasons, and they've specifically been attributed to energy drink consumption. And part of the reason is in these energy drinks and these energy shots, the energy shots actually can be even more problematic because it's because of how quickly you consume them. And so if you think about, you have a cup of coffee, it has 100 milligrams of caffeine, but you kind of sip that coffee slowly. You're not you know, taking a shot of that coffee all at once or consuming it really quickly because the nature of coffee drinking, the temperature of the coffee, all the things sort of makes you slow down. And so the rate of the caffeine getting into your body is sort of extended over a period of time. When you do an energy shot or even an energy drink and you drink several of them really quickly, there is the potential for cardiac arrest and for toxicity. And so even though it's extremely rare, there is the potential there because, you know, if you have too much caffeine, it can be lethal.
A little daily dose of caffeine insight for you there from Jennifer Temple, who studies the effects of caffeine on children. She's director of the Nutrition and Health Research Laboratory at the University at Buffalo. And that's it for our show today. Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. Cole Wissinger engineers the program. Ciara Hewlett and Cleon Wall produce the show with help from Joe Carson, Sam Faulkner, Cecilia Foster, Crystal Gerber, Haley Kendall, Scott Nielsen, Hayden Reeve, and Hannah Syriac. You can find us online at byuradio.org/topofmind. And you can get our podcast by simply Googling Top of Mind Podcast. You might also try asking your smart speaker to play the Top of Mind Podcast. Our email address is topofmind@byu.edu. We'd love to hear from you. Let us know what you think of the show, topics you'd like to hear us discuss. I'm Julie Rose. We'll talk soon.